Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Pod Yourself a Gun, a Sopranos podcast where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Sopranos and talk about it. It is the world's only Sopranos podcast, and we thank you for listening to it, although you had no other choice. Isn't that right, Vince?
That's right. I miss when people used to say onlyist. Like, I was watching some...
Was onlyist a thing?
Yeah, like Muhammad Ali. I was watching an old Muhammad Ali interview, and he was like, I'm the onlyist fighter, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but he made up lots of words. That was like part of the charm.
I don't think that was just him, but in any case, we are the onlyist Sopranos podcast.
We are the world's onlyist Sopranos podcast. By the way, a joke that I've done on the internet a few times and had people scream at me on Twitter. Because they are like, you are not the world's only Sopranos podcast. And I'm like, you know that this is a joke about you, right? This is at your expense. But we actually are the only, so please don't go and look for any other ones. Vince and I, we talk about everything in the episode, from the mise-en-scene to the scene-on-mise. We love art, and we love to talk about it. And our guest today also loves to talk about it, and loves to talk about everything from the tech world to the rest of the world. Ladies and gentlemen, from the New York Times, it is Mike Isaac. What's up, Mike?
Hey, how are you? You have basically encapsulated my whole life, tech and everything else. That is right. What I like to talk about.
Those are the two things, you know, and, you know, I realized that this is one of the rare times where I didn't double check the intro with the guest. I didn't be like, hey, so are you okay with, and so I just kind of made it up as I went along. I knew that tech was in there, and I knew New York Times was in there.
All there is to me, really.
I didn't miss anything. I mean, you know, I could say how many. You got a lot of followers on Twitter. That's a big thing.
I got a few. That, I guess, is, although I feel like that is not something I would lead with. I feel like that's kind of sad right now. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's not sad. Maybe that's cool.
What about the book? I mean, you're trying to sell that. Did still,
right? Yeah, actually, I will push that right now. I wrote a book. It's a tech book. It's on Uber. It's called Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, but it's really a larger, I won't go into the whole thing, but it's really a larger view on how fucked up the tech world can be and how companies can implode and all that stuff.
So, Did you buy that book?
Did you get into Travis? I read the book, but I can't remember if you got into Travis Kalanick's thing with the ghost kitchens, or was that like too?
No. We stopped. Do you know what this is, Matt? Do you know the ghost?
I know you're about in LA. I know about the ghost kitchens. Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't it like you didn't get served by a person? You got served by a robot that put it in a box, and you had to eat the box.
You get served by a ghost, actually.
Yeah, you get served by a ghost.
No, it's
No, the ghost kitchen. Sorry, there's many, many tech things that they're all coming back to me now. The ghost kitchen is a kitchen that is multiple restaurants.
Yes, that's right. Like, yes, they ran out of. There's this thing in San Francisco. What's it called? It's some robot kitchen thing where you like walk up to the box and you take the food out. That's what you're thinking of, but this is not that.
I just had to go through kitchen. the post-apocalyptic Rolodex of weird, technological marvels that we had to endure while living in San Francisco.
Yeah, I know, right? You're lucky you got out. No, this is his. This is, I didn't get into that in the book. That's sort of what he's doing now, Travis Kalanick, former CEO of Uber. Now he's down in LA with Matt, doing ghost kitchens and
we live together, nothing. Me and Travis.
Yeah,
dude.
I think it was like I kind of got done with the book, and I was like, what's Travis Kalanick up to these days? Maybe he like has learned his lesson. And he's like doing something like good now, and then immediately got into ghost kitchens, which is like of all the tech things, I think it's like the most dystopian because it was basically like. He got money from like, I don't know, like crazy, like Saudi money and all these like random dark money people. And he got this money and he used it to start this thing where like it basically has turned into where like they use data to find out what food is popular in an area. And then they like create like a concept for a restaurant that only exists online, and then they hire like random you know, gig workers to make the food for to make the menu that's so all dystopian. Based on data. It's super insane. Fucking
dark. It's like it's like this view of food where it's just sort of like, it's sort of like Soylent, where they see like food as like something to be like distributed and consumed without like the idea that maybe you like going to a restaurant or maybe, you know, it's super fucked up.
Yeah. Or that like, you know, a human touch matters in someone cooking something for you.
Robots.
Yeah. They're like, no. Robot chefs, dude. It would be like, this would be like if, Vesuvio and that shrimp restaurant that's really the sushi restaurant that's really popular in season 6, like if they were in the same place. I'm trying to tie it to Sopranos.
No, I got
doing a great job.
What it reminds me of is like when I used to say, like when you go to a bad like diner that does breakfast and you get those, the bad home fries, which I used to call them fuck you potatoes, because it's they're serving you the idea of potatoes because they know people like potatoes with breakfast, even though like the chef doesn't give a shit about them at all. So like ghost kitchens are basically like only that, like we know people like this one thing, so we're going to serve you the idea of this thing without without like any love or investment in it. Anyway, I just That's what your book led me to, was these dark fucking articles about ghost kitchens.
That's it. Thank you for reading it. That's cool.
That was great.
Anyways, well, that's enough. That's enough about non-Sopranos topics. All right. I don't know what you think people came here for, guys, but I'm pretty sure it's not ghost kitchens. It's I'm gonna get it. Hold on. It's not ghost kitchens. It's ghost
fishing.
Sleeping with the fishins. Anyways, boom.
Got it, dude.
Oh god, I'm sweating now. But before we get into the rest of the show, I would be remiss if we did not lead off with the theme song. Pod. Pod. Podcast. Pod. 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 Podcast. Thank you. That is literally why we bring people on this podcast. I just want them to hear.
Yeah, we can just end the podcast now. This is why Matt does it. He wants a validation for his song mashups.
I laughed. I was laughing. That was good. Sounded like the Crystal Method meets Matt Lieb.
Yep.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what I was going for. All right. So today we are talking about season 3, episode 7, Second Opinion. Vince, can you break us down a little bit of that synopsis?
Sure. Tony convinces Uncle Junior to seek a second opinion for his cancer treatment. Meanwhile, Carmela debates whether or not to take Dr. Melfi's advice and see a shrink. Big Pussy's wife, Angie, regrets asking Carmela for some money to help her sick dog. And Christopher continues to endure a humiliating probation period at the hands of Kinky Polly.
Ooh, Kinky Polly. Yeah. I like that. There's a little flair. They definitely tease a little bit of what's going to happen with Polly in this episode without giving too much away. So yeah, Vince, this episode came out April 8th, 2001. So I think we should get a little bit of cultural context of what was going on in America when this episode was out.
Yeah. Are you talking about firing up the Remember When machine?
Oh, you're goddamn right I am, dude.
Good. I love it. You know, art doesn't exist without cultural context, and that's why the Remember When machine exists. Walk, walk, Teddy Daddy Bob Bob Shoe Bob. Remember
then. Remember when is the lowest form of conversation.
Boom.
Headlines. Well, let's start with happenings. On April 8th, 2001, Tiger Woods won his second Masters tournament.
Wow. He was still in the good graces of everyone, right?
Yeah, people loved him. They were like, there's no way this guy fucks. Which is weird. I gotta say,
not realistic.
The entire, like, I'm now looking back, you know, to the entire, like, Tiger Woods fall from grace. Not really the worst scandal I've ever heard.
The worst part about that was, it was like, this guy's the best golfer in the world. The only problem is that he's the most boring human alive. And he's
today, I rate my long irons game about like a C, hit the short irons.
And then he finally does something to make himself interesting. And then he immediately starts sucking at golf. And it's just a shame. Like,
yeah. And it's weird because it's like, you know, like, just look at how unhappy this dude is while playing golf. Yeah. When he's like, the one thing that he is good at, he is the most unhappy at. Like, I've never seen him smile on a golf course unless he has won. You know what I mean? You could tell there's a lot of sadness in the fact that this is his gift. Yeah. And like, just let the man fuck.
I know.
Didn't he grow up with like a really intense dad?
His dad was like, it was like,
there was crazy stories about how Earl Woods used to supposedly do like William Tell type shit, where he would stand like 10 feet in front of Tiger and like make him hit balls and make him hit balls over his head and shit. I don't know if that's true, but like, that's
it, coward. Do it. Yeah. Hit the ball right in my teeth.
Like, but that is really, I mean, and also it's little Tiger Woods going, Daddy, I don't want to do it. You know, he's like a sad little nerd kid. Oh, man. Ooh, like, just let him fart, dude.
You're a killer tiger. Do it.
No, Dad, I'm a baby bird.
Yeah, I've always said, like, being... if someone wanted to be the Dennis Rodman of golf, it would be so easy. Like, people were.
You got to be kind of good at golf first.
He wears like an orange hat. Like, you don't have to do anything. It's easy.
Yeah. You know, I read both of Dennis Rodman's autobiographies when I was in middle school. Not just Bad as I Want to Be. But yeah. What was the next one? Like,
I didn't know there was a second one.
There were two. He was naked on both covers, and nice. I think I looked up to him as a kid.
Yeah, I did too. But I liked about him was that he seemed to be able to be a basketball player without being a great scorer. And I always looked up to that because I was like, see, that's gonna be me someday. I don't need to learn how to like get the ball in the hoop. I'm just gonna block and I'm gonna rebound. And I was bad at that too, but it gave me hope.
Yeah. There weren't a lot of interesting headlines on this day, but I did find this one strange story in the New York Post. And I think you'll know why I picked it in a second. The headline is just "Pressed into Service." Panino is not the newest character on The Sopranos. It's the hottest sandwich in New York. Although,
oh my God,
Jesus, that is worse than Matt's segue.
Although it comes in many varieties, the panino, little bread, is generally a grilled concoction of sliced meat and cheese, or it can be vegetarian, with a little oil and perhaps a sprig of rosemary and garlic between two slices of focaccia. Ingredients range from the simple to the exotic, but the secret of this sandwich is in the grilling.
Now I swear to God.
Yeah.
This headline reads like, and this was the last time that Italians were considered ethnic in America. Like, this, they are talking about this like it's this ethnic food. Like, the panino, as it's called in Italia, is a little bread sandwich.
It's very like local newscaster. Like, you can just imagine a local news reporter being like, it's called panino, and your kids could be doing it.
Yeah, holy shit.
Is that
shit.
A different thing than a panini? Like, is a panino... the proper,
I don't know.
They, like, bastardize it and became panini.
I think
panini like plural.
Yeah, I think panini is just the plural.
Oh,
Oh my God! I didn't know that. Like, there was a. I mean, of course, there was a beginning date for America's obsession with a panini sandwich. Yeah. I just didn't think it was, you know, April 8th, 2001.
You didn't let me get to the kicker of this article.
Oh, please, please.
Great. Now you can have commercial quality grill to use at home. The Panini Professional Grill with deep-ridged cast iron grilling plates, hinged weighted lid, temperature controls, and indicator lights quickly and evenly cook sandwiches or a steak at up to 575 degrees. And then in the parenthetical, it's $899 through the Williams Sonoma's catalog.
Oh my God. Jesus Christ.
Holy shit. That's incredible. And I think relevant to this podcast, which is, I mean, I got to say it, so far, both of the things in the Remember When machine are relevant. We're talking golf and we're talking Italian sandwiches.
That's right. Yeah. I didn't check to see this, but I don't know when the George Foreman grill was invented, but I have to imagine it was just around this time. It was just like the time when America was crazy for grilling.
Yeah, that's no, but exactly. they wanted electric grilling. They were done with charcoal. Yeah. They were like, this is America. We do electricity grilling and we do it inside the house and it is more healthy for you. Like that was the time we were living in, you know, pre-9/11 America.
I was thinking like, is a George Foreman grill just a Panino press? Like that, like is
it is.
It's half it oh, is? I guess it is, yeah. It is a whole Panini.
No, it's a whole. It's a Panini press. But it's like at an angle so that all of the delicious parts of the juices can roll off.
You can dry your sandwich.
Yeah. You get a nice dry sandwich.
It dries as it cooks.
Steak in it.
Sounds great.
Set it and forget it.
Top movies in the country were Spy Kids again. Mm-hmm. Along Came a Spider, which was I believe. Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
Saw that in the theater.
Yeah.
And Blow.
Johnny Depp.
That other drug movie.
It's a movie about drugs.
And
I wonder if that holds up.
Top song. Yeah. Oh, there's a great turn by Paul Rubin in that movie. He's, you know, he played a good.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Played a good scumbag. Right. Top song, still Angel by Shaggy.
Oh, thank God, dude. That song was on top for so long.
Yeah,
Shaggy, true king of the 90s. All right. And by the way, I'm calling it the 90s because let's be real. 2001 is still the 90s. Let's get in to this episode. I think this is a fantastic episode. And I just want to say I know that I have a history on this podcast of telling the Bada B stories of the episode in some sort of like novelty rhyme. And I'm just not going to do it this episode, Vince. I've decided.
Okay.
Yeah, I've decided not to.
You're so, like poetry. You got over rhymes. You're just like, no, we don't do
that. Yeah, you know, just too many rhymes. And I just can't this time. So here are the Bada B stories. A novelty gift reminds Tony of Pussy's death. A big mouth Billy Bass. Chris sees Polly sniffing AIDS panties, making Polly a big nose smelly ass. Junior loves Dr. Kennedy, which makes him a doc simp really trash. Carm sees a Jewish therapist who tells her the truth. Jew mouths leave his ass. All right. I did it anyways, you guys. I did it.
Good job.
I rhymed things and God, I put way too much work into this podcast. Yeah. So let's talk about it, Vince. So, where do you want to start?
Well, I wanted to ask Mike, was this, I know you're not watching, you've seen this before, but you're not watching it in sequence. Was going back out of sequence, was there anything that you felt like you missed or like, did anything seem out of left field or was it all pretty straightforward?
So I am going to admit something that might get me canceled or kicked off of this podcast, but
it'll happen.
I only watched like half of The Sopranos years ago. Like I haven't, and I've sort of picked up all the sort of cultural moments over time and I know the arcs, but this is really my first time back through. And now I really liked this episode so much. I'm going to just go back and now do the sequential stuff. And then
I can do
your podcast along with it. But yeah, it's been.
So you never fit. So you don't actually know the ending. You never.
I mean,
finished
I got the ending through osmosis and like,
sure.
The, like discussions of what happens or doesn't happen or whatever. But like, I will be pretty fresh when I go back through it, basically.
Well, that's fun. Listen, we've had people on this podcast who have not finished the series. I think we've had a couple of people who had never seen it at all and just watched one episode randomly.
Right.
And you know, the truth about this podcast is we don't really care. We just want guests.
Well, just I was available.
Someone to talk to in these lonely, lonely times.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it was... it did remind me of like how I'm kind of curious if you guys think this, there's like an element of like camp to this show.
Oh, know, yes.
That like is self-aware, right? Like it's like but I was going to get your take on it. Like, do you think that was just sort of, they were going into it with that or I don't know. Like,
I think part of it is that TV was campier in general in this time period. And I think like we remember Sopranos rightly as like one of the first prestige TV shows, but I think prestige TV is less openly schlocky and like less campy, where I feel like The Sopranos is the first prestige TV show, but it still comes from, you know, the medium being sort of a more campy, like more schlocky kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's weirdly ahead of its time, and that's you know, I know that's something that everyone has said, and I am a hack, so that's fine for me to say that. But what I mean by that is that like it's got camp, but it's strange that a show could be so self-aware in the kind of infancy of prestige TV because of the fact that it's like it starts off with this kind of sitcom-y premise and almost kind of a formula where you've got, you know, the
mafia
therapy
guy gets a therapist,
right? Exactly. And then the therapy is like a way for you to process the emotions of the rest of the story and whatnot, and you get to see it's like very formulaic, kind of like Breaking Bad early seasons, where it was like how am I going to use chemistry to get out of this pickle I'm in. It definitely breaks out of that mold and kind of becomes its own thing, which is impressive.
Yeah. And let me just say, I think the best TV shows and the best movies really are the ones that realize that TV is supposed to be like a little bit bad, and movies are like, they're supposed to be an element of, you know, like there should be an element of embarrassing earnestness, like in everything, I kind of think. Like anything that has at least a little bit of that is better.
Things should more often than not realize that they're unimportant.
Yes.
And I think that always helps a lot. It was just one of the annoying things about a show that's this good, though, is that once it becomes important to you, then you really start becoming invested in where the writers are going to take it, which is one of the reasons that you probably heard how everyone hated the ending and whatnot. And like David Chase's whole thing, I think I heard him say something like, you know, at the time I was like, is this really more important than the Iraq war? And I was like, oh, I'm going to strangle you in your fucking sleep, bro. Like, how dare you? Like,
God damn.
We know it's not as important as the Iraq war, but I'd like to know what happens. I'm not a fucking, come on.
Did y'all had to have read those like retrospectives that we did in the Times a few last year or whatever? Like, didn't we do?
Oh,
what happened? Did he come out with a book? I can't remember why they revisited it. Maybe it was like
the 20-year anniversary of the show
or whatever. Yeah,
yeah.
And it was interesting. It's weird. I mean, I brought up the camp thing because it's strange for me to come back and watch a show like this after becoming so, like, I feel like I've gotten down not the formula, but the tenor of what prestige TV shows are like now. And it's very much like, okay, I'm going to sit down and watch, not even The Wire. What's something more recent that's like prestige on HBO, or let's say Watchmen or something, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like super gritty, not realistic in the sense that the plot is realistic, but just sort of like less sort of like acting on a stage play sort of a vibe, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so it really did sort of take me back into this. I mean, we were talking about Seinfeld earlier. It really kind of reminded me of Seinfeldian setups of what characters talking to each other is kind of looks like.
Yeah.
Does that make
sense? They didn't hate when they made this, like they didn't run away from the idea of a scene having like a button or like, you know, like dialogue having like a scenes themselves having like a punchline. And
yeah.
And I like that. I like, you know, at least when they're good at it, it's great. Like,
Yeah.
So like this episode, it starts with a dream sequence, which is not unusual for The Sopranos, but it is a junior dream sequence, which I think is the first that we've had.
That is a first, yeah.
Yeah. So, but then there's that weird moment where Dr. Kennedy. Episode is all about Dr.
It's all
John
about Kennedy.
Kennedy.
Yeah.
So he gets a phone call while he's doing surgery on Junior, which was slightly confusing to me at first because he kind of seems like he's connected all the time and I don't quite understand how.
It sounded like that he was getting a call from like the other room. That's what I thought was happening, and basically they took out the specimen or whatever, the cancer, and inspected it, and he was trying to hurry him through the process. So, he's like, did I get it or not? And the guy's like, yeah, you basically got it.
So the first time I watched this episode, I thought he was talking about Junior, but I think like that was like a biopsy from another patient that he was hearing about, I thought, when the second time I watched it, was it
really?
But why would he be getting? He can't be getting like results of the biopsy while he's doing.
I don't know how doctors work, bro. It could be.
I don't know.
They do magic inside.
It was just this weird disembodied phone call where he talks about the specimen and doesn't say anything.
To me, that was just a setup to show that this is an overconfident, overbusy surgeon. Who, because he just wants, like, you know, to give it to me straight, doc, he's saying to the guy who's like trying to tell him, and we find out later that he's probably trying to tell him, like, you know, you may not have gotten all of it, so I would, you know, like it felt like he was trying to rush this dude through it, and which ended up being a mistake. But yeah, it starts out with you know, Junior getting the surgery, and apparently Dr. Kennedy is a magic man who Junior is in love with. And I just have a clip about what this episode's about. It's called Kennedy.
Kennedy.
Where the fuck is he?
This episode is all about Kennedy, and Junior has a strange obsession with both his name and with his ability that Tony doesn't share. And we start out with Kennedy coming up to Tony in the group and saying that, you know, hey, he did great. We got the cancer out. Everything's good. And there's this moment where Tony comes up to him and he says, like, hey, if there's ever anything you need me to do a favor for you, you know who to call. And Kennedy goes, like, I'll keep that in mind. And then Tony shoots him this look. What do you guys think? What was going on with that look? Has he never had someone say, oh, yeah, I'll consider it before or what? What do you think was going on there?
I was trying to figure that out. I mean, I don't know. I'm curious what you think, Vince, but it just seemed like he was... He didn't anticipate that sort of, maybe it was the doctor didn't give him like the props of saying, oh, I appreciate that. Or thing, you know, like was like as deferent as the idea of like a big mob boss guy was going to do you a favor. Like you should be a little more.
Yeah. It was like,
I think you can definitely read it as, you know, him not showing like the expected deference. But I also think you could just read it as Tony thinking this guy is kind of a smarmy prick, but not being able to put his finger on why yet. Like, you know, when you which I think is where we are as the audience in that scene. I feel like there's just, you know, there's times when you meet someone and they seem like an asshole and you don't really have evidence for it yet. You just have like a feeling. That's kind of the way I read it. I don't know.
No, I think that was it too, because, It did seem like maybe he just got this feeling like this guy is up his own ass and thinks he's like Jesus, you know, reincarnated on Earth. And he got that all from just his reaction to, you know, hey, if I'll do you a favor sometime. Like it was a very strange moment, but it definitely, if there's one thing that I think Tony is, I mean, other than like a sociopath and all that stuff, it's that he is perceptive about other people's scumbaggery. You know, it's almost like he's got like game recognized game when it comes to like narcissistic douchebags. And so I think he saw a little bit of narcissistic douchebag in him. And from that moment on, he's kind of questioning Kennedy's abilities, whereas, you know, Junior is pretty sure that Kennedy is, you know, Jesus.
Aren't surgeons generally assholes or just like very full of themselves, right? Apologies to any of your surgeon listeners.
No, I think that's true.
I think that's the stereotype, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's a stereotype that I'm only familiar with because I think my mom said it to me once. Like, I don't know why I'm familiar with the stereotype.
On your wedding day?
Yeah, on my wedding day, she was like, if you ever meet a surgeon, tell them to go fuck themselves.
No, but
it does. It's something that I don't know why this is like a widely known stereotype of surgeons, because it's not like I don't have any surgeon friends. I don't got not one surgeon friend, and I don't think I've met a surgeon who is
why.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, exactly. I don't go to their hangouts.
We should go back to the famous Weird Al song "Like a Surgeon" and just see what you know, what stereotypes he puts in there to describe what surgeons are like.
Yeah, maybe. But it's like it's definitely a strange stereotype that exists, and I think he's kind of like living up to it. But what's strange to me is
the entire plot of The Nick starring
I never watched that.
I love that show. So good.
I saw the first season of it and I was like, pretty good. I really like that Clive Owen fella.
Yeah. Dude, you know? I learned about him through BMW Films. Do you know what that is?
What? No.
He literally did. The way he got to start was he did commercials for BMW.
Clive Owen?
Yes. And they were he did five like short films directed by like John Frankenheimer, Ang Lee, like serious directors.
Yeah,
literally
I remember
just about
these.
BMW. Yeah. And that's how he became like more of a thing.
That's how he became famous? I had no idea.
I didn't remember that either.
I didn't know that was Clive Owen's origin story. But I did watch The Nick, and I remember there being a lot of morphine in that show, and I was like, sick. But yeah, so Junior is head over heels in love with Kennedy, and one of the reasons is that he's obsessed with his name. He is obsessed with the fact that his name is Kennedy, and there's a scene where Tony is just trying to convince him to seek a second opinion.
When they say you could eat real food?
Who knows? Kennedy's put me under the knife again.
Oh, back up. More surgery? Don't you think you should talk to somebody else, you know, get a second opinion?
Chemo? Forget it. With Kennedy, it's cut, zip, over and out. He has the hands of an angel. And don't forget his name.
What? I'm supposed to be impressed because the man's name is John Kennedy? All the mix named their kids that after the guy got killed.
You were gone a long time. How many White Castle did you have?
I didn't, I swear.
I can smell them. My nephew thinks I need a second opinion. He doesn't like it that I'm going back under the knife.
Maybe there's something to that.
Think on this, burger boy. Anthony is a cunt hair away from owning all of Northern Jersey. And I am that cunt hair.
Think on this, burger boy.
I just love it. He immediately, as soon as Bobby comes home, is just like, how many White Castle do you have? And then he's like, I didn't. He's like, I can smell them. Just the idea that he's like, there's one sense that he can smell. It's like, my sense of smell is perfect, and I know White Castle when I fucking smell it.
So I was curious about the choice to have Junior be obsessed with John Kennedy, which is, it's an interesting choice because, as Tony points out, like, the mob doesn't like traditionally like the Kennedys and, you know, probably had him killed. So,
but if you'll notice, there's a theme in general with Junior and Kennedy. Like, this isn't the first time that he's brought up Kennedy. Didn't he have, Remember that girlfriend that he had, who he smashed the cake into in like season one?
Yeah.
Doesn't, and he has like a John F. Kennedy hat or some shit. Oh. Remember?
I don't remember the hat.
And she like puts on the hat and does the happy birthday, Mr. President, and whatnot.
Yeah.
So
I think it's like he, well, between JFK and like Angie Dickinson, and I think he has like, there's something about like that mid-century romance. Like he's very sort of media and movies.
He's nostalgic for this very particular period in his life. Yeah, Kennedy's president. And you know, part of me is like, I could see sort of a mafia admiration for Kennedy in some sense, being that it's like for them, even though he's, you know, not a, even though he's Irish, he is a Catholic, and also, you know, his father was a bootlegger, so in a way it was like, hey, it's like one of us, it's nice to see the representation is important in the presidency, you know what I mean?
And they also got him elected,
you know, so it's like I could see Junior having like a Kennedy obsession, you know, kind of like thinking that he's great and whatnot. And you know, Vince, he explains, I think, in a perfectly reasonable way, why he does love Kennedy. And it's I have a clip of it.
What, you mean he's not Kennedy? You make life and death decisions because of a man's name. Let me ask you something about this JFK worship of yours. What about Hoffa and the Teamsters?
That was their brother.
Oh.
Boom. That is a perfect, that's a perfectly cromulent explanation, in my opinion.
Yeah,
that was the brother. The brother did all that bullshit with the, you know, going after the mafia and the Teamsters Union and stuff. So, you know, you can't blame the brother for the crimes of the brother, you know? That's a famous phrase in Catholicism. Anyways,
do you have Al Pacino as Hoffa in your head now, or do you have Jack Nicholson?
I
or
still,
does it not, is that not a big impression on you?
I gotta be honest with you, I don't have any picture of Hoffa in my head when I think of Jimmy Hoffa. I have this like cartoon of like a person who my brain has turned Jimmy Hoffa into this cartoon that I thought of when I was a kid the first time I heard the name Jimmy Hoffa, which was in Ace Ventura Pet Detective. And so my version of Jimmy Hoffa, it looks very strange and nothing at all like Pacino or Jack Nicholson. I need to see The Irishman again.
It's hard because like he's been played by two actors who are notoriously like always themselves in a weird way, you know what I mean? Like whenever you see like a Jack Nicholson movie, he's always Jack Nicholson, and whenever you see like a Al Pacino movie, he's kind of always Al Pacino. So I don't know how to bridge the gap between those two.
That's a very good point. They really, you know, if you want to like, if you want to have the character be someone, you know, that you remember, you pick a complete unknown and you make them, you know, good at the character. Not to say that Al Pacino and, you know, Jack Nicholson aren't good. I just, they're just them the whole time. You know,
they should have got Chadwick Boseman to play him.
Oh, Chadwick would have done great. R.I.P. R.I.P. to a real one. So what ends up happening, at least in this storyline, is, you know, Tony makes him go to a cancer board or a tumor board, and they all discuss what the options are. And Dr. Kennedy decides, he says, fuck it, because of the fact that, like, he's got some other doctor looking over his shoulder now, which, by the way, this episode always scared the shit out of me, because nothing scares me more than attempting to be an advocate for your own health and having it completely fucking backfire. Like, it's very death of a salesman, you know, like Willie Loman asking for a raise and getting fired and just trying to be like, never mind, I will go back to work. You know, like, it's like, to me, that's very frightening, and it sounds pretty realistic, like it's something that could happen.
I mean, the guy already has a huge ego anyway, right? Kennedy does. And so like, I could totally see, I'm the same way, man. If I go to like, I would hope to think if I had cancer, I would be a better patient advocate for myself. But like, it's also like, I don't want to piss off the doctors. So I guess I'll go with what you're saying, sort of.
Yeah. Thing. I mean, it's not like I'm not afraid they're going to open me up and put more cancer in, but it's like, I am afraid that they're going to be like, you think you're going to get another opinion better than me? Well, you know what? Fuck you. I'm never giving you medicine.
Yeah. It's funny because the second season of the Dr. Death podcast just came out today or yesterday. And like, it's basically about a doctor who gave people chemo unnecessarily, who didn't even have cancer, but he basically like told them they had cancer so he could get all the money from all the chemo treatments.
Jesus Christ. So what the fuck?
That is fucked.
That is so what the fuck?
So this is like a good 1-2 punch of like, wow, I don't know what to do if I have cancer.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. Like, there is part of me that's like, you know, if you just did a little bit of chemo every day, like, you would never get cancer, right?
A little bit of is that like eating poison for a very long
time? Yeah, right. It'd be like, just keep eating a little bit of poison and then you'll never get poisoned.
No, it's you're getting the cancer gradually used to chemo so that if you ever have cancer.
Oh, you're getting super cancer.
Yeah, the cancer's like, oh, nah, dude, we already built up a tolerance to all this.
See, this is why I'm glad that I'm not in control of my own health. Because like every time I hear about anything that's like, oh, like part of me is like, why don't we all do the Michael or what's his name? Who was the biker with cancer? What was his name?
Oh, the guy who's an asshole?
Yeah, Livestrong.
Lance Armstrong.
Lance Armstrong.
I was thinking another kind of biker, but yeah.
Yeah. The guy from Orange County Choppers. What the fuck, Vince? You know how Lance Armstrong like had like a fridge of super oxygen blood and like and that's like how he cheated. But like, I feel like, okay, so you shouldn't do that if you're competing. But what if you're just like just trying to like have a good time? I don't know. It just seems like oxygen
just
blood.
Chilling? I would love to have super blood.
Yeah, super blood sounds like something that we could all use. So,
well,
I don't know, man.
If you're a tech CEO, you just get like a kid.
Yeah, you got a blood boy.
You get a blood boy.
Yeah, that is very normal here. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, yeah, like I get having a blood boy. And I'm just saying, if you got the money, get that blood. But there's something inherently frightening about the fact that a doctor's ego could be the reason that you die, you know? And ends up being completely ignored by Dr. Kennedy. He's not getting any of his calls returned. And Tony is mad about it and he's had enough. And he decides to go visit Dr. Kennedy on the golf course, which is, I gotta say, up until this point, this is my absolute favorite Furio scene in The Sopranos. Vince, what do you think?
Oh, I mean, he's had a lot of good scenes, but yeah, this is, in terms of the entire episode, like, I don't think this is in the top 10 of Sopranos episodes, but
sure.
This scene, the Furio scene, is in my top 10 of Sopranos scenes, like, individually.
It's very good.
Extremely intimidating. And then was that like a recorder that he threw in the pond?
So this is another question I have about Dr. Kennedy is he's getting the disembodied phone call in the operating room in the first episode. And then throughout the episode, he's making notes into a recorder. And I'm kind of like, she's not getting those recordings in real time, right? So like, does that mean he like record stuff throughout the day and then sends her like gives her the actual tape that she has to listen to all day? I'm so confused at how that works.
This has to be like a vestige of like, you take contemporary, like, remember I was watching Mad Men a while ago, like, and they'll do like a dictation where they sit down and dictate their thoughts and you just give them to the person at the end of the day. Maybe this is like pre-cell phones being good and everywhere, so that was I've never seen that. It's really weird.
Yeah, it's funny that you guys say this, because this whole time I thought, I don't know why, I thought that was a phone call. I didn't know it was a recording thing. I thought he was making a call on a cell phone, but now I look back at it and I'm like, oh yeah, this is 2001. They didn't have fucking flip phones. but yeah, I have a clip of that scene, Vince.
Anyway, what am I going to do with it? I already got one, and Mr. Williams here, he don't play.
Stupid the fucking game.
What is it, Jack?
I'll just be a minute.
Well, I could use a little extra distance.
Who couldn't? You know, my uncle, he's not doing so well. He's got a bad reaction to that chemo.
That happens all the time. There's nothing that I can really do.
You know, there are worse things that can happen to a person than cancer.
My uncle thinks he's going to die.
He was a surgeon, that's all.
You got to be on your hat.
I love you. You got to be on your hat.
Yeah.
Of all of the things... Like everything that he's doing, he's there for like kind of like tough guy emotional support, which I love. He's just like, it's good cop, bad cop. But you've got to be in your hat is just the best pretense that he could think of in that moment to knock someone's hat off. It makes me wonder if there's like, is that an Italian thing? Is there?
It's very like, it's very big brotherly or like, if someone actually has a bee on their hat, you know, it's so nice. It's so old timey. Like, oh
yeah. It is a little big brotherly. It's like if he's like, he just starts taking his arms and going, oh, why are you hitting yourself? You know, it's just, hey, you hitting yourself. Oh, why you do that? I wish I could do a perfect Italian accent.
I don't know
accent.
Which line I like better. Stupid a fucking game or...
Stupid a fucking game.
You gotta be on your hat. Both,
yeah.
Because they're both so good. And I like why? That he calls him Mr. Williams, like my associate Mr. Williams. And he just... And he's just staring at him stone-faced.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Williams is just, it's an intimidatingly fake name, you know? Yeah.
It's like, we respect
Mr.
you
White.
So, yeah, we respect you so little that we're not even going to come up with like a realistic fake name.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's very scary to see this like very clearly European thug. And then just like, Mr. Williams here, you'd be like, oh, fuck, he's going to kill me. And he has no fingerprints.
Yeah.
Like, that is very, very scary. But yeah, he knocks out the recorder off of his hand, which I now realize was just his little doctor recording device. Yeah, and knocking that,
you learn.
It worked. It actually worked in terms of he just goes to visit. He goes to visit Furio goes to visit Junior at the hospital while he's getting chemo, and his chemo doctor is Tony Hale.
Yeah,
you guys know
Buster Bluth.
Buster Bluth himself. Who is
that? Is that Buster?
It is. And it's fantastic because Buster is doing so... I'm sorry. I'll call him by his real name. Tony is doing so much in that scene in terms of like he is so funny without even trying. Like, because Dr. Kennedy comes up to him and he goes, you got a top guy here. Pats him on the shoulder. And Tony just gives him this look like is he talking about me? and then while he's continuing to have the conversation, you see Tony Hale just looking at the saline bag, very confused. he's poking at it, and it's all happening in the background, and I'm like, god damn it, that dude is a genius. He's one of the funniest people in the world, in my opinion. Love him.
It was, yeah, excellent part
about typecast.
Oh yeah, but oh, sorry. But yeah, so that is, you know, mostly what's going on with Junior. Meanwhile, Tony is having a rough one. So Tony's, I think, main role in this episode is just to be kind of a receptacle for other people's mishigas. And the only kind of like individual storyline that he has just himself is this... this scene that he has with the Big Mouth Billy Bass,
yeah,
which is makes multiple appearances in this episode,
which is big for you, Matt.
It is very big for me. As some of the listeners to my mine and Vince's previous our other podcasts, the Frogcast, know, you know, Big Mouth Billy Bass's and I have a long sordid history.
You have a thing?
Well, you see, when, so Mike,
I apologize.
Can I call you Mike?
Please.
Well, so when I was a kid, you see, we had a Big Mouth Billy Bass, and as I was like in seventh grade, and I saw that it like it had a robot mouth.
Did you fuck the mouth?
No.
I don't know you that well.
That is correct. But the problem that, so I didn't actually, because you can't fuck the mouth, but I was very intent on doing it. So I just ripped off the skin and I masturbated with it. The skeleton was still singing while it happened. So I have
an audience.
Yeah. I had musical accompaniment to me just masturbating, saying, "Take me to the river." And so, yeah, I have a history with Big Mouth Billy Bass. So this is a very important episode.
6-word memoir. The skeleton was still singing. kind of thing. You're like, well, can't fuck the mouth, so I'll just masturbate with its skin.
Sometimes you're already halfway there, you know what I mean? You're like, sure. I've already brought it from, you know, the mantle to room.
What did you do to hide the evidence? Did you just like bury it in the yard or?
No, under the bed.
Okay.
I just threw everything under the bed. We had in my family, you know, everyone knew under the bed off limits.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty smart.
There was like, that's the under the bed is where all the secrets go.
Yep.
Because
were you also a Catholic like me?
No. We just put everything that we masturbated with in under the bed. His porns were under his bed. My mom had a vibrator under her bed, and so I was like, I'm gonna put it under my bed. And rules are rules, and it was fine.
Respect the bed rule.
That's very healthy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every family to have.
Yeah, you really got to throw things out when they start to smell. So let's move on. So it does make an appearance and it's very good. Chris,
can we talk
and
about
Pauly.
How Georgie is just the
he's
just the guy that everybody beats up when they want to feel strong about something? Like,
yeah, he is the punching bag. I mean, because in the pecking order of the mafia, a bartender / bouncer is the lowest, you know, rung on the totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I feel, and also he's a big dude.
He's so unimportant that he has to actually do work.
Yeah, he's like doing accounting and shit like that. Like he's doing actual, like he gets paid a salary. In fact, I have a clip of Tony discovering the Big Mouth Billy Bass.
Oh, what's up?
Hey, Tony.
Matt's getting aroused right now.
Anyway,
ooh.
$4 a pound.
Ooh. Rip off its skin and fuck it.
Georgie, it's wacky, huh?
What do you think, it's a fucking playroom back there?
What, Tom?
What? Fucking toys? It's a place of business. That's an office back there.
I saw it at Rite Aid. They were selling them.
What? What did you say? I pay you a fucking salary.
The fact that he pays Tony a salary, or Tony pays him a salary, is just that's just a great button to the scene where he's like, yeah. Hey, listen, you're getting benefits here. Yeah. Do not bring right. a Rite Aid novelty gift
you
into this establishment.
You have a 401k.
You have a 401k.
Exactly.
Do you think that the Big Mouth Billy Bass was like the last ubiquitous novelty gift? Like,
I feel like I don't know. I'm trying to think of what the last one was. I mean, I remember there was the guy with no pants. He would stick to your back window of your car, and you'd you know, squeeze the thing, and his pants would drop.
Mm-hmm.
You guys,
I don't remember that. Oh, I do remember truck nuts.
Yeah, truck nuts are also but that's not really a novelty gift so much as it is just something that's super cool.
What about the drinking bird? Do you remember that?
I do, but that's way older than Big Mouth Billy Bass.
I forgot to mention I'm 92 years old.
Well, there's like the sculpture thing. It looks like a little African man like in a barrel, and you lifted the barrel and he had like a big, it had a big dick on a spring.
I don't know this one, but that sounds.
Bill Clinton actually had. I remember that partly because we had one, and I know Bill Clinton like ordered an aide to go get him one because he thought it was so funny. Apparently,
Jesus, we should have known.
Yeah,
we should have known at the time.
I don't know, but all I can think of is like I don't know, fidget spinners and like Tickle Me Elmo.
Fidget spinner. I think that's kind of. I mean, it's not novelty, though. I don't know if there has been a novelty gift that has surpassed the Big Mouth Billy Bass. I think it's just, it's like, that was we reached peak novelty gift in 2001. Yeah. And people, you know what happened? 9/11.
That's why the terrorists hated our freedom. They saw that.
Terrorists saw that and they were like, you know, while you're taking these fish to the river and dropping them in the water and sometimes ripping off the skin and fucking them, you know, we are being exploited by your country and then did terrorism. But yeah, moving on. The one thing I do love about the appearance of the Big Mouth Billy Bass is so Chris and Polly have this whole storyline, right? And just to go through it real fast, it's basically Chris is getting fucked with because he's newly made and Polly is like, hey, new rules. We get to strip search you whenever and blah, blah, blah. And at some point during like a random search, Polly goes into Chris's underwear drawer or into AIDS underwear drawer and start sniffing her panties. And this causes some friction. Chris tells Tony and Tony actually basically lays down the law with Polly and says like, you can't do that, which by the way is a really great, it's a really great scene because he has some rules, you know, around that where he basically tells them, hey, you know, as soon as they're married, then, you know, hands off, you know, but like he's like, I can fuck with this kid as much as I want to, including smelling his fiance's panties up until the point that they are married in the eyes of God, which I absolutely love.
Yeah. No ring. You're allowed to sniff the panties.
Right. And everyone knows that's in the Bible. That's just a rule. Everyone knows.
When she's married, hands off. But until then, those are community panties. Anybody.
That's right. That's right. That's for everybody. Everybody gets a taste. But what I love
is trying to wet his beak.
Yeah. Oh, that is perfect. That is what this episode should be called. Alternate title, Wetting Your Beak on AIDS Panties. What I love is that the Big Mouth Billy Bass comes back as this weird kind of mea culpa. It's not even a mea culpa because he doesn't say sorry, but they have this very tense scene in the car where I have a clip of that. For people, it is called.
I got it.
Okay.
So what is this? Huh? Some new rule about who I fuck? You want more shoes? What?
No. Funny thing is, they don't even fit her. I don't know why I thought she was a size 10.
I don't know either.
I'm here to tell you one thing. You ever go whining to the big man again about shit between you and me, we'll have a problem, my friend. You seen these?
Fuck is that?
My godson got it for me. They were all over the fucking place.
Just the dumb laughter around watching a Big Mouth Billy Bass, two literal psychopaths sharing a laugh over a singing fish. Just like, that's the show, you know?
Perfect.
It's one of the things, it's one of the reasons that I'm like, Sopranos is the best show ever made.
That's why the Billy Bass was popular right there, you know, bringing people together.
Yeah, exactly. Mortal enemies who, you know, may or may not try to kill each other at some point.
Panties are water under the bridge.
Exactly.
After that, right.
Exactly. After that, that's the best I'm sorry someone can get.
Seriously. So I'm now thematically connecting in my mind. It didn't occur to me necessarily when I watched the episode, but Polly being mad at Christopher for like breaking the chain of command is similar to Tony getting mad at Angie Bumpincero for telling on him to his wife. In the same way.
Interesting.
I
didn't think about that.
Yeah, so I had a question about that. So Angie runs into Carmela at the grocery store and complains about her dog needing an operation. And then Carmela tells Tony about it and he shows up at her house. And the way he describes it is he gets pissed when he sees that she's driving around in a Cadillac. And meanwhile, bitching for money for the dog. He breaks her windows and her tail light, and then he's like petting the dog, and he's like, I don't know, dog looks fine to me. And then they have that moment, and I don't know if we're supposed to believe that Angie Bumpincero was actually like lying about the dog and was trying to like do a kind of a shakedown move of her own, or
yeah, what? I couldn't tell, like, you know, because she goes, it comes and goes, and she sounded in that exact moment like she was lying, but yeah. Everything else up until that point, it just seems like a really roundabout con, so I couldn't imagine that she was actually conning him, trying to get more money for a dog operation, but then again, you know, who knows what these people.
She had the Cadillac, yeah.
Yeah, she had the caddy.
And, Carmela has proves herself to be a sort of a soft touch for people who need money, as we see in the other storyline, which is the dean of fucking Columbia, of all things, trying to get $50,000 out of a mob wife, which... I'm kind of with Tony on this one. That's kind of they probably have like $1 billion endowment and they're trying to shake down the mob wife.
It is definitely one of the times in the show where I'm like, hey, Carm, maybe listen to Tony on this one. Like he knows a thing or two about extortion. And this is something that you should seriously consider, being that you're already giving this school tens of thousands of dollars in tuition payments. It's kind of insane. But she's, for some reason, sees it's a way of, I think for her, laundering blood money, and kind of like putting it to good use. Like if we're going to live, off of other people's blood the way we do, it'd be nice for it to mean something. I think it's means something beyond helping our child get out of, you know, this life or whatever. Yeah. I think it's also, I want our names to be attached to something that's not the mafia. Like if it's attached to a building at Columbia, it's like, you know, it's.
I totally didn't even think about that with the other therapist that Carm goes to see as sort of like saying, you are now complicit. And if you didn't know that before, you know that now, because I'm telling you that now. And he wouldn't take the mob money, basically.
Yeah, he straight up is like, I won't take blood money.
I like that storyline, because like the whole time with Melfi, you're like, God damn it, Carmela, just open up. You'll have one confidant in this world that you can actually talk to. And then she actually goes to the other shrink and you're like, ah, finally, Carmela's going to be able to open up and stop being so goddamn guarded and lying to herself all the time. And then she gets like the meanest fucking therapist in the world.
Giant asshole shrink.
She gets the best shrink. It comes at a point in the show where I think the show is so... has become so aware of what it's doing with the Melfi scenes that they were like, what if instead we have kind of like the opposite of Melfi, kind of a complete no bullshit, like judgmental therapist. I love it. And I think it's like, it's the only time this therapist makes an appearance on the show, and it's just the best therapy scene in The Sopranos. Before we go, I just want to play one of the clips from that. It's called...
I got it. You can say the name of it if you'd like to people to know.
I forgot what it was called. Jew
it's,
something?
It's called Jew Therapy.
Okay. play Jew Therapy 1.
Okay.
I may be overstepping my boundaries here, but you are Jewish, aren't you?
Is that relevant?
Well, us Catholics... We place a great deal of stock in the sanctity of the family. And I am not sure that your people...
I've been married for 31 years.
Well, then you know how difficult it can be. He's a good man. He's a good father.
You tell me he's a depressed criminal. Is that your definition of a good man?
I thought psychiatrists weren't supposed to be judgmental.
Many patients want to be excused for their current predicament because of events that occurred in their childhood.
That's what psychiatry has become in America. Visit any shopping mall or ethnic pride parade to witness the results.
I'm so confused
Dad?
About the...
God damn.
I'm Dad, so is that you?
I'm so confused about the ethnic pride parade part of that. Like, what did that mean?
It felt like such projection that I was like, this just sounds like something my dad would have said at some point. It just, it was this, like... You know, this idea of like, oh, everyone wants a participation trophy. You want to get a, you want to get a round of applause because you're ethnic. Like, it's but it was such a weird kind of like departure from where what he was actually talking about that I was like, I just thought it was beautifully written. This character was so funny, and the first character I think in the show who was bluntly said. You're in the mafia and your husband should be in jail and you need to get out now. Mm-hmm. And then he says, at least now you can't say that no one has ever told you. And beautiful. I loved it so much.
She got the exact wrong person for her, or maybe right person. I don't know. But like, yeah. if the goal is to at least ease some of her pain and whatever, we let us get to her. She got the wrong guy.
Well, it didn't work though, because she kind of just turned back on him. She's like, "Oh well, you know, this is what Jews would tell you." But
the moments of anti-Semitism in this episode are great because it's like stuff like you're Jewish, so you don't understand, you know, being in love, and
and he's like, "Yeah, you don't have respect for marriage," and he's like. Oh, no, I think you're thinking of the Puerto Ricans.
Yeah, right. Excuse me. You're thinking of the blacks and the single mothers. Like, I love...
Yeah, it's such like a weird... Like, they both did racism. Like,
did racism.
She tried to do different ways.
She tried to do racism on him, and he's like, oh, no. I can do better.
But that's what... I love that they're just both characters are doing it, and it's just it's just different shades of white people who think they're ethnic, and it is mwah, it is beautiful. All in all, I gotta say, solid B+ for this episode. Just a lovely ride all the way through.
The solidest. You know? So then we had in our Gabavafangul section, in which we try to explain some of the Italian slang words. There was Christopher was saying that was Polly was being a spaccone, and and I looked it up, and of course we have a Stevie B to explain that for us, who explains all of our Italian slang words. So here we go.
Hey, how's all doing? I'm Stevie B. I want to give a special Italian-American slang word of the day shout-out to David Florenzano. And the word of the day, spaccone. Spaccone. Every once in a while, payday for the shop, I'll be over at Louis' joint. Who shows up? Good-looking Charlutz. He just got paid, and good-looking Charlutz is throwing money around, acting real important like he's somebody, acting like a real spaccone. Every so often, I'll stop by the local tavern to decompress. If it's a Friday payday, I'll probably see Handsome Charles. Having just received his pay, he tends to try to impress, buying the ladies drinks and such. Handsome Charles acts like he's a real big shot. Spaccone.
Gotta love Stevie B.
Oh my God, that was amazing.
He's just incredible. At some point, we're going to get him on the podcast. He's just some dude we found on YouTube, and he's a genius. What can I say? He's a real spaccone. I forgot what he said at standard. Oh, it means big shot. That's what
big
it means.
Shot. He actually is a spaccone.
He is. Big shot. And speaking of spaccones, thank you. Thanks so much.
I'm honored
for coming on, Mike. We really appreciate you. Where can people find you on, like, Twitter or, you know?
Oh, Instagram? Yeah. No, this is super fun. You have really officially inspired me to go back and watch the series now, and you have a listener. Nice. And me, this Spacone right here, will listen.
Hell
to
yeah.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Mike Isaac, ISAAC, or you can read my technology coverage in the New York Times, or get that book, or I don't know, maybe more podcasts. I'll do this one again when you get closer to the end or something.
Yeah. I'd love to have you back on.
Right on.
Thanks for coming on. Frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, concerns. Patreon.com/Frogcast. That's where you can donate to our Patreon and hear bonus episodes of Vince and I talking about other shows, not just The Sopranos, but everything. And, you know, even if you don't, listen to the Frogcast, maybe you just want to donate because we do this podcast for free. Patreon.com/Frogcast. Vince, what's the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, don't stop believing.
Don't stop. Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA, so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.